of all places and people, why did Our Lady deign to appear at Fatima? Let us reflect on the nation's history and the fervor of her people, which merited precedence for Portugal in the design of divine providence. Originally Celtic, Phoenician, Greek, and Carthaginians, they became a single race known as the Lusitanians. They were industrious in fishing, herding, growing grain, and mining, copper, bronze, iron, and gold. They also imported gold and traded jewelry throughout the Mediterranean. The Romans invaded, conquering a coastal area. The central highlanders proposed peace and laid down their arms. Once at the mercy of the Romans, most were slaughtered and the rest enslaved. Their leaders, Istolatius and Indortes, were crucified. On another occasion, a surrendering chieftain was spared. The Romans contented themselves in merely cutting off the right hands of his warriors. The northern Lusitanians were rallied by Viriatus, originally a shepherd. He successively defeated five Roman generals until finally drawing the entire Roman army into an ambush. Instead of decisively defeating the enemy, he honorably called upon them to petition peace. 2 years later, the Romans deceitfully renewed hostilities. At long last, the folk hero Viriatus was betrayed by bribery and treacherously murdered in his sleep. He had given wise reproof to those who wished to coexist with the Romans. Such compromise, he told, is like a man who had two wives, the one old, the other young. The old wife pulled out the man's black hairs, while the young wife plucked out his gray hairs. And soon the man was bald. His warning was evidently taken to heart. As the remnant Lusitanians held out for another 40 years, in all, completing a century of warfare. During the following four centuries of Roman rule, roads, bridges, and aqueducts were built. Roman municipal government would become the method by which the Portuguese would administer their future colonies for a millennium. Lusitanian resistance was again tested during five centuries of Moorish overrule. By the 8th century, Islam was established throughout Portugal, except in the northern highlands. From this rugged territory, a militant reconquest of the nation was waged, the Reconquista. By the 7th century, Lusitania extended to the settlement of Calais on the Douro River. Here, the river-crossing portorium toll was exacted, hence from the term portorium, and the name Calais was derived the nation's name Portucale, or Portugal. Muslim forces continued to pour over from Africa, intent on imposing a new dynasty, the Almoravids. Both Portugal and Spain petitioned assistance from Christian Europe. The monks of Cluny exhorted French knights to respond to the appeal. Henry from Burgundy led the troops, gaining dominance of the Portuguese harbor of Oporto. On April 9, 1097, the northern third of Portugal's coast was secured from which territory was waged continued assaults against the central and southern Muslim castles and cities. The son of Henry from Burgundy, Prince Afonso Henrique, led the troops against the forces of four Moorish kings at the Battle of Arique on the Feast of St. James, St. Santiago's Day, July 25th, 1139. The Portuguese were encamped on a hilltop, being surrounded by Muslims and outnumbered 100-1. Alone in his tent, Afonso read the sacred scriptures account of Gideon's victory. He was later favored with a vision of Christ crucified, to which he swore upon the cross and the Holy Gospels. I take the following several quotes from the book, The Miracle of Arique and the Birth of Portugal, by Hugh O'Reilly, as quoted in Tradition in Action. Confident in God, Afonso said to himself, Thou dost know very well, Lord Jesus Christ, that it is for love of thee that I took upon myself this war with thy adversaries. Now it is in thy hands to give to me and to my men the strength to destroy in thy name these blasphemers. He fell asleep and dreamt of an old man announcing to him, Afonso, have confidence, because you will conquer and destroy those infidel kings. You will smash their power, and the Lord will appear to you. He was awoken by his chamberlain, who told that an old man wished to speak with him. It was the man of his dream, a hermit, who told that he had lived amidst the Moors for 66 years. He assured Afonso that he was beloved by God. He would be victorious, and God would favor his descendant kings unto the 16th generation. The influence of Portugal's royalty would then diminish for a time, though remaining under divine solicitude. That night, Afonso must go out of the camp alone on hearing the hermitage bell, for God would then reveal such divine favor. Afonso prostrated himself in reverence to the hermit and in gratitude to God. The bell summoned him in the second watch of the night. Going out, he saw a resplendent light in the eastern sky, which each hour became more brilliant and defined, until finally being brighter than the sun and taking the form of the cross amidst angels. Afonso knelt and unselfishly petitioned that such a vision be given to the infidels for their conversion. Why dost thou appear to me, O Lord? Dost thou perchance desire to increase the faith of one who has so much? It would be better, most certainly, for the enemies to see thee, so that they might believe in thee, rather than I, who since baptism has known thee as the true God, Son of the Virgin, and the Eternal Father, as I know thee now. The Lord lovingly explained, I do not appear to you in this way to increase your faith, but to strengthen your heart for this conflict and to establish the beginning of your reign on a firm rock. Confidence, Afonso, because not only will you win this battle, but all the others where you fight against the enemies of my cross. You will find your people joyful and fortified for the combat. and they will ask you to enter into battle with the title of king. Raise no difficulties, but readily concede to all they ask of you. I am the founder and destroyer of kingdoms and empires, and I desire in you and in your descendants to found for myself an empire, by which means my name will be known in far-off nations, and so that your descendants know who gave them the kingdom. You should place on your coat of arms the price with which I redeemed the human race, the cross and the five wounds, as well as that by which I was sold by the Jews, the 30 coins. And it will be for me a holy kingdom, pure in faith and loved by me. Afonso adored, prostrate on the ground, saying, By what merit, O Lord, dost thou show me such great mercy? Place thy benign gaze, then, on these successors that thou hast promised me, and safeguard the Portuguese people. And if it happens that thou hast planned to send them some chastisement, let it fall on me, and free this people, whom I love like an only son. The Lord assured, My mercy will never leave either you or your people, for through you I have prepared great crops, and I have chosen them for my harvesters in the most remote lands. King Afonso reigned 50 years with continual victories, which freed nearly all of Portugal. The Moors retained only the lower third coastal area, having been driven out of the lower inland hill country. King Afonso's immediate successors reached the southernmost region, the Algarve, in 1249, thereby fully eradicating the nation of Islam. As the separate troops of Portugal and Spain advanced on their southerly course, they determined their border by mutual agreement. The Moors, however, were only thrust out of Spain 2 centuries after their expulsion from Portugal, in spite of Spain's having greater forces than the Portuguese. The Moors would remain a threat to Christian Europe for one more century, until the united Christian fleet gained the decisive victory at the Battle of Lepanto on October 7th, 1571. In gratitude for the swift reconquista of Portugal, the Cistercian monastery and church of Santa Maria del Abassa was erected. The monastery of 999 monks held continuous praise of God, the Laus Perenne, both day and night. No fewer than 40 priests remained in solemn adoration, which continued uninterrupted for 5 centuries. In one village reclaimed from the Muslims in 1158, there lived a beautiful Moorish princess named Fatima. She converted to the Catholic faith, taking in baptism the name Oriana. She married Count Consalvo Jimenez, a favorite cavalier of King João. She died young. Count Consalvo dedicated his life to God, joining the monastery of Alcobaça. He was later sent to establish a priory in a small nearby village. He had his wife's remains transferred to the village and gave it her original name, Fatima. Hence, this village, where the Mother of God would deign to appear, is named after a convert to the faith who rejected Islam. Let us take hope for the conversion of the Muslims in our troubled times. For on the feast of Christ the King, we renew the act of consecration of the human race to the Sacred Heart of Jesus, wherein we pray, be thou King also of those who are still involved in the darkness of idolatry or Islamism, and refuse not to deliver them out of darkness into the light and the kingdom of God. The next militant era was Portugal's war to maintain independence from Spain. The great general Blessed Nuno Álvares Pereira, the future King João I, customarily attended three masses a day and obliged his soldiers to attend one. In explanation of his devotion, he exclaimed, "Rob me of this divine food, and you rob me of my victories." His 10,000 soldiers were surrounded, being outnumbered five times over. Confident in divine assistance, he had his troops attend Mass and receive Holy Communion. He then engaged against the Castilians rather than delay for reinforcements. The several following quotations are taken from the article Nossa Senhora Patroness of Mexico by Ana Maggio, as printed in the Four Marks August issue. With Our Lady's image on his banner, Blessed Nuno called upon his troops to attack in the name of God and the Virgin Mary. God favored such devotion amidst daring exploits, and the Spanish troops were utterly routed. Another battle loomed the following week. Blessed Nuno besought a sign that although greatly outnumbered, his forces would be victorious by the intercession of Our Lady, Queen of Portugal. Kneeling before her image, Nuno vowed that if victory was given to the Portuguese, he would build a beautiful monastery in her honor and make a pilgrimage of thanksgiving to the sanctuary of Our Lady of Oliveira. His troops then advanced to the location of Mount St. Michael, close by Fatima. The Battle of Aljubarrota was fought the next day, the eve of the Assumption of the Blessed Virgin, 1385. The Portuguese were up on a hilltop, and so the Spanish were able to fire them from down below. The Portuguese, however, being hindered from firing back on account of being upon their horses. The horses began to kneel, thereby allowing the Portuguese to fire upon the Spanish, having a decisive victory. With its decisive victory, the Portuguese enjoyed 2 centuries of peace and independence. Blessed Nuno fulfilled his vow by building the Dominican monastery and church of Santa Maria de Vitoria in the nearby town of Batala, Portuguese for battle. The church was the first in the world to be dedicated in honor of Our Lady's Immaculate Conception. For several centuries, the Dominicans of the monastery of Aljubarrota preached the rosary to such effect that the laity prayed the full 15 decades daily. So common is this devotion that the Portuguese soldiers and sailors were required to carry a rosary. In the Peninsular War, the Portuguese soldiers, to the surprise of their English officers, presented their rosaries during the morning uniform review. Blessed Nuño also founded and joined a Carmelite monastery. In receiving the habit on the feast of the Assumption of the Blessed Virgin, he heard her image. He heard her speak from her image. Come to me, wear my sign, and I will make you a saint. Be perfect, find my son, imitate me. During the Fatima miracle of the sun, Our Lady appeared under the title of Mount Carmel. Not once only, therefore, but twice in connection with Fatima, the Virgin Mary exhorts us to wear her livery, the Holy Scapular of Mount Carmel. Also at Fatima, Our Lady called upon Lucia, Francisco, and Jacinta to spread devotion to her Immaculate Heart. Nearly three centuries earlier, in 1646, King João IV renewed the ancestral vow, entrusting Portugal to the Immaculate Conception. He called upon the National University of Coimbra to defend belief in her Immaculate Conception, the professors so binding themselves under oath. He placed his crown at the feet of the statue of the Virgin and expressed confidence in the infinite mercy of Christ and the mediation of the Blessed Virgin. He pledged that the increase of the realm would be for the glory of God, of Christ, and the exaltation of Holy Roman Catholic Church, the conversion of pagans, and the submission of heretics. This national consecration to Our Lady and crowning of the statue of the Immaculate Conception were no mere formalities. Her kings placed their crowns perpetually before her, never wearing the crown, even on their coronation day. The statue of Our Lady at Fatima was crowned with one such royal crown. Along with consecration to Our Lady is devotion to the Sacred Heart of Jesus. Portugal is the first nation to have erected a basilica dedicated to the Sacred Heart of Jesus, the Basilica da Estrela, the Royal Lisbon Basilica and Carmelite Convent of the Most Sacred Heart of Jesus. These were built at the order of Queen Maria I in fulfillment of her promise for the favor of having a son as heir to the throne. Let us enthrone our homes to the Sacred Heart of Jesus, wherein the Catholic faith will be fervently lived and no occasion of sin will be tolerated. In 1936, our Lord revealed to Lucia why he would not effect the conversion of Russia without its being consecrated to the Immaculate Heart of Mary, because I want my whole church to acknowledge that consecration as a triumph of the Immaculate Heart of Mary, in order to later extend its cult and place devotion to this Immaculate Heart alongside devotion to my Sacred Heart. Portugal's empire for the glory of God and the exaltation of the faith was achieved in a mere century. By daring discoveries, she colonized or came upon half of the world. She was the first European nation to reach beyond continental Europe, and hers would be the longest-lasting colonial empire in history. A primary motive for her voyages was to search out the fabled Christian kingdom of Prester John, rumored to exist somewhere in the Indies. Portugal desired to align with this nation so as to effectively assault the Muslim Empire, both from the west and from the east. Three times, Portugal's troops assaulted Morocco, and in 1415 captured Ceuta. These assaults, as well as the voyages of exploration, were coordinated by Prince Henry the Navigator. In his lifetime, maritime ventures reached halfway down Africa to the Great Western Cape, also discovering the islands Azores, Madeiras, and Cape Verde. Sailing under a white banner, emblazoned with a purple cross, the ships went forth, not without missionaries, to provide Mass and the sacraments for the intrepid crews. They also dedicated themselves to the conversion of the natives. In 1498, Vasco da Gama sailed round Africa's Cape of Good Hope, achieving the longed-for sea route to India, also arriving at Madagascar, Mozambique, Zanzibar, and Arabia. He was accompanied by two religious of the Order of the Most Holy Trinity, one of whom was martyred in spreading the faith in India. In thanksgiving for da Gama's voyage, and at the site of his embarkation, a monastery and church were erected, the Geronimos Monastery, and the Church of Santa Maria de Belém, Belém being Portuguese for Bethlehem. Fittingly, the first gold from the East African trade was used to make the monstrance for the Church of Belém. Portuguese sailors continued exploring the Red Sea, Persian Gulf, East India as far as Sumatra, passing on to Siam, Asia, Japan, and China. By 1571, the Portuguese Empire was fortified by outposts clear to the Portuguese-founded Nagasaki, Japan. A British historian asserts that no nation treated its colonial peoples with such humility, kindness, and consideration as did the Portuguese. Missionaries administered the colonies until proper governance was established. The boundaries of the empire were fully hemmed by missions, churches, and religious houses. At one time in Africa, there were over 250 Dominican missionaries. In 1890, a dispute arose concerning colonies claimed both by England and Portugal. The British wished to amiably resolve the dispute and so researched the archives of the Dominican Order, for wherever the missions were to be found, there was established the realm of Portugal. Other explorations are Greenland and Canada. Brazil was discovered, perhaps also Australia. Other expeditions were captained by Portuguese who sailed in the service of Spain. Among these was the circumnavigation under Ferdinand Magellan, himself being killed in the Philippines in defense of a converted chief. Still other voyages came upon California, Mexico, Peru, Southwest Pacific Islands, New Hebrides, New Guinea, and the Asian Islands. Not only spreading the faith, Portugal aided its preservation in Ireland during persecution by the English. The Irish priest, Father Dominic O'Daly, known as Dominic of the Rosary, was counselor to the King of Portugal and confessor to the Queen. At her own expense, the Queen had the church and college of Corpo Santo built, gifting it to Father Daly. The college was known as the Seminary of Martyrs due to the many priests who gave their lives in Ireland. May we have a missionary spirit. Volunteer your assistance in your parishes. Be generous supporting and maintaining this grand church and facilities here in Mount St. Michael. Pray for the spiritual and temporal success of the missions. As able, donate to the St. Francis Xavier Missionary Fund in Omaha, which assists foreign missionary efforts. According as we pray for the missions, God will more abundantly bless our own parish efforts. Portugal was successful in the missions, since also fervently practicing the faith at home. The following quote is taken from the book Church and Society in Catholic Europe in the 18th Century, edited by William J. Callahan and David Higgs. The Irish architect James Murphy describes his visit to Oporto in 1789. The first thing that strikes the mind of a stranger on his arrival here is the devout appearance of the inhabitants. Religion seems to be their only pursuit. The clattering of bells, the bustling of processions, and the ejaculations of the friars engage the attention by day, whilst every part resounds by night with the chanting of hymns. Saints and writers entitle Portugal as a patria da divina Eucharista, fatherland of the Eucharist. Portugal, as also Spain, retained the practice of daily communion, as attested by St. Jerome, whereas other Catholic nations were departing from this apostolic tradition. There are lay confraternities of the Blessed Sacrament, the Irmandade do Santissimo. These amount to between 3 and 4,000, being established in virtually every town, village, or even hamlet, with members wearing special attire and a dark red cape or cloak. These provide for processions and escort and accompany the clergy on sick calls. As the priest carries Holy Viaticum, the bell is rung, the number of strokes indicating the direction by which he will pass. From fields and homes, the faithful come forth. Praying and singing hymns, they accompany him on this holy journey of a mile or two, perhaps even three. Candles are lit in the windows of the homes. Thus, the whole community is preoccupied in praying for the peaceful passing of the soul from this life. An incident of recent times in Lisbon attests to this custom. The royal court, the king, royal family, and nobility were attending theater. The tinkling of the Vatican bell was distinctly heard through the open windows. Immediately, the king, the nobles, the entire theater, the very actors on the stage, sank on their knees until the bell was no longer heard. In Lisbon, by papal enactment in 1682, perpetual adoration is observed in the same manner as in Rome, being rotated among the churches. Only the great Lisbon earthquake of 1755 interrupted adoration for a time, being then resumed and remaining in observance. Perpetual adoration is observed elsewhere, with churches having great Eucharistic thrones as high as 30, 40, or even 50 feet in symbolism of the heavenly throne of the Lamb. There are massive silver tabernacles, such as that in Lisbon, being 8 feet high. Even larger and richer is that in the church of Santa Maria de Belém, having been gifted by King Afonso VI in 1665. That in the Cathedral of Oporto, along with the altar and Rereros is the most magnificent and beautiful. Here, French soldiers invaded in 1800, stealing six lamps and the massive silver candlesticks. They would have further desecrated by removing the tabernacle had not the quick-witted sacristan prudently painted the silver tabernacle over, giving it a stucco appearance. All-night adoration was once observed during the war to maintain independence from Spain. This was in the besieged fortress town of Elvas. The commander, the Count of Villaflor, ordered the troops to adore through the night and to confess and communicate. At dawn, a sudden and full assault was waged, which put the enemy into a panic as they threw down their weapons and fled. To confess and communicate was standard practice throughout the era of discovery. One who neglected this would be dismissed from the crew. The typical claiming of newly discovered lands was to have mass offered at an altar on shore, attended by the crews and native people. Though the caravel ships were small, it was unimaginable to sail without missionaries and provisions for the holy sacrifice of the mass. Vasco da Gama and his crew spent all night adoration before departing on his epic voyage. The Blessed Sacrament was reserved on each ship. The crews attended Mass on Sundays, as also Saturdays, Our Lady's Day, and on feasts, none being more solemn than Corpus Christi. Due to the devotion of the Portuguese for the Blessed Sacrament, desecration was rare. Offenders were punished by law, and due reparation was offered. One such sacrilege was committed on the night of January 15, 1630, in the Church of Santa Engracia in Lisbon. The Queen herself, with 100 noble ladies, formed among themselves a perpetual association, the Slaves of the Blessed Sacrament. They had masses offered, prayed, and observed devotions in reparation. Into modern times, the association remains faithfully observant and flourishing. The best-known Eucharistic miracle dates from 1266. Communion was sacrilegiously received as the woman then placed the host in a handkerchief, intending to give the sacred species to a Jewish sorceress in return for an occult favor. To her dismay, drops of blood marked the floor of the church, from the communion rail to her place, while also staining her clothing. She hurried home and placed the host in a box. As her husband arrived, he saw a light coming forth from the room where the box was placed. Along with his wife, he entered the room. As they saw that the light came forth from the box, the woman told him of her sacrilegious reception. They informed a priest, who, accompanied by a large concourse of faithful, came to bring the host to the church. This sacred host in Santarem is still blood-stained, being displayed in a beautiful crystal luna receptacle. Santarem is also the site of a Eucharistic prodigy. The Dominican priest, Blessed Bernard of Morlaix, tutored two young boys. At his advice, they ate their midday meal before a statue of the Blessed Virgin and Divine Child, while also leaving a portion of their meal before the Divine Child. Recall how the children of Fatima charitably gave their lunches to poor children and made a sacrifice of eating bitter acorns. Well, the divine child came down from the arms of his blessed mother and told the boys of his beautiful home in heaven. This conversation was daily repeated, inspiring the boys to ask to be taken to heaven. Yes, the child promised, on the following Thursday, the Feast of the Ascension. Recall Our Lady announcing at Fatima, "I come from heaven." "Shall I go there?" asked Lucia. "Yes, but you must say the rosary." "And Jacinta?" "Yes." "And Francisco?" "Yes, but he must say many rosaries." Francisco indeed fulfilled Our Lady's bargain by praying many rosaries. The little boys asked their priest tutor for permission to accept the invitation to go to heaven. Yes, he allowed, after ascertaining that they had truly received divine visits. But he made a condition that they could not go to heaven without their good priest. Blessed Father Bernard prepared the lads for First Holy Communion. On Ascension Day, he offered Mass privately, with the lads serving and receiving their First Holy Communion. Pope St. Pius X made it standard practice for young children to be admitted to communion so that the grace of this sacrament will strengthen them to preserve their innocence even as the world becomes more corrupt. Recall how the Angel of Portugal prepared the children of Fatima for the visions of Our Lady by administering Holy Communion for young Francisco and Jacinta. Drinking the precious blood from the chalice was their first communion. Having concluded Mass, Blessed Father Bernard knelt expectantly at the foot of the altar with the boys. Let us never neglect praying some prayers of thanksgiving after Holy Communion. Still in devout thanksgiving, the three were called to heaven. Other religious of the monastery found them still kneeling, though no longer of this earth, and with faces radiant with spiritual joy. The message of Fatima resonates of devotion to the Holy Eucharist. Francisco would spend hours adoring before the tabernacle in reparation. Lucia and Jacinta would find him in church having knelt all day. They would help him to stand up, for his knees were sore and bloody. To receive Holy Communion in reparation is a condition for the promise of the five first Saturdays. Our Lady, accompanied by the Divine Child in her arms, appeared to Lucia in 1925, giving the wondrous promise that whoever fulfills the five first Saturdays of reparation to her Immaculate Heart will be saved. In appearing at Fatima, Our Lady asked that a church be built. The faithful were already leaving money offerings at the site of the apparitions, for the Portuguese are fond of pilgrimage sites. In the 1700s, such countryside chapel shrines, known as capellas, were founded for particular devotions. These shrines were confiscated following the Civil War of 1834. The rightful heir was impeded from assuming the throne. The older prince had forfeited his right to rule Portugal by becoming emperor of Brazil. However, he sought to obtain the throne of Portugal for his daughter, and so he called upon foreign Freemasonry to obstruct the legitimate government of Portugal. By Freemasonic interference, thousands of religious priests, monks, and nuns were banished from Portugal and its colonies, with lands and religious houses being confiscated. In 1908, King Carlos, and the Crown Prince were murdered. By 1910, the anti-clerical faction boasted that in two generations, the practice of religion would be exterminated. Attendance at Mass diminished, and the reception of the sacraments was neglected. The Irish Dominican Order had not been expelled since being under the personal favor of the Queen. These clergy launched a rosary crusade, which in 2 years resulted in the establishment of 350 Eucharistic confraternities and the revival of many formerly observed. Little Jacinta Marto, shortly before her death, sent a most consoling message to the fathers engaged in the Rosary Crusade, saying that Our Lady blessed it and bade them continue without fear. Let us recall the revelation made to Portugal's first king, João I. He would be blessed, and his descendant kings, unto the 16th generation. The royalty would then diminish in influence for a time, though remaining under divine solicitude. Could it be that Our Lady came to Fatima as the herald of divine favor? For in coming to Fatima, she rekindled the fervent practice of the faith. 1 million pilgrims attended the May 13th coronation. As many as 350,000 pilgrims attend on major feasts, coming by distances on foot. Masses are offered on 40 altars, with 33,000 receiving Holy Communion. Local hotels can only accommodate 2,000. The rest sleep in the open countryside. Always they come praying the rosary. A custom in Lisbon tells of families standing in their doorways reciting the rosary, actually by chanting the rosary, one side of the street leading, the other responding. In modern times, they come to the windows, one lady at 5 p.m. clapping her hands, calling attention for all to pray the rosary in their homes, one side of the street leading, the other responding. They pray the rosary on a journey, such that they tell distances by how many rosaries it takes. So devoted are the Portuguese to Our Lady that the girls all have the name of Mary or Maria. And so, since having the same name, they need to be known by their secondary name. We have reflected how, in so many respects, we would do well to imitate the devotion of the Portuguese. Might this be why Our Lady appeared at Fatima? Is she calling upon us to be fervent in adoration and reception of the Blessed Sacrament? Was Fatima chosen as the place of apparitions to emphasize her divine son's request for devotion to her Immaculate Heart and the daily recitation of the rosary? Need we propose any other reasons why Portugal was favored in our times? The Blessed Virgin Mother of God is acclaimed Nossa Senhora, Patroness of Portugal. Yet Our Lady never claims attention to herself without drawing us to a greater love and devotion to her divine son. Fittingly, therefore, she deigned to come to Fatima of Portugal, which nation, with good reason, is entitled a Patria de Divina Eucharista, Fatherland of the Eucharist.